That's the approach we might look at. I'm kind of like a tennis ball today, bouncing off the walls, both sides. But is the practice now, do you generally just call the psychiatrist who's done the examination and say, do you think he's really kooky enough to put up an insanity plea? Or do you get a written report? We're talking about a superintendent who keeps copies, I'm sure. And
they go routinely to all parties, any kind of examination. That's been one of the problems with the incrimination.
Well, and this is what I'm getting to, is we're filing an official report in triplicate according to the draft as it now is. As a defense lawyer, I'd be a little hesitant to say, now would you also throw in a few goodies about whether this guy is... Mm-hmm. It's climbing the walls or not.
You'd be waiving your Fifth Amendment right, wouldn't
yeah,
you? On
I
the insanity question, under Shepard versus Bowe. Yeah, you got that terror. We're in a dilemma.
Yeah. Well, knowing the answer ahead of time.
Who is the lawyer from the bar committee? Raised this very question at the commission meeting.
Mm-hmm. I know. I can't think of his name either.
He said, well, it's sort of the fruit of the poisonous tree or something.
Yeah,
Bruce Rothman.
Yeah. No, this is directed at that, and I think that the commission at the time kind of felt that, well, gosh, we shouldn't be getting the answer of both questions on the same exam.
Yeah, that's true, but boy, I'll tell you.
I can see it. Well, there's another problem, too, that's on the horizon, and I think we've looked at this before with respect to expense to counties. The reason why the defendant, of course, does this is because he can't afford to hire his own psychiatrist. This is an economic, strategic request, because he knows, under present practice, I think universally in the state, that the psychiatrist, when asked on the incompetency question, will also routinely reply on insanity also. Therefore, he saves himself the expense because he hadn't got the money. Now, I think indications again are in the United States Supreme Court that we're not too far away from the day when the court will say you have got to furnish him a psychiatrist as well as a handwriting expert, an accountant, a fingerprint expert, a full array, again, of experts for the indigent defendant, just as we now must supply counsel and one or two other experts. It's already expanding. So eventually, I think, down your throat or whichever way you want to look at it, the counties are going to have to pay psychiatrists.
But of course, but of course, bear in mind, though, that from the standpoint of the day-by-day, dull, bread and butter type defense lawyer, doing a good job, competent, and so on. He wants a look at what his chances are on an insanity defense. Now, and he gets it this way cheaply, mm-hmm. With no cost, actually. Also, if he doesn't get it, he can very well harm himself in handling the case, because if he sees right off the bat that he doesn't have an insanity defense, then he goes to work and looks toward a negotiated plea and so on and so forth. Whereas if he's got to go through all the motions and run the risk of this thing and get the extra exam, he might very well find a lot of them just taking a lot more shots on the insanity defense, and of course, once that falls on space, then your guy's in there for the full ball of wax. And whereas if he had been shot down right at the start, he'd have gone around, negotiated the plea, and copped him out to lesser included, and been on his way. And while this sounds crass and so on, this is in fact the practical aspect of it.
In light of what you say, and in light of what Dave says, try this on for size, and am I correct in this? If, in fact, the original report, all reports not only on incompetency, but also on the insanity issue, which means implicitly that the psychiatrist is asking him about the crime itself, because he can't give his opinion otherwise. We know that. The psychiatrist has told us. Okay. That means that he's got to ask about the crime. Obviously, the defendant, who wants to assert self-incrimination under Shepard versus Bowe, would be entitled to do so. It would be improper, therefore. Now, Dave says that the way the defendant might get it is to request that when he's sent for incompetency, the defendant would say, I also want to be examined for insanity. And that means, then, does it not, that the defendant is waiving his Fifth Amendment right at that point.
As to that examination?
Yeah, as to that exam. So therefore, the only way to approach it would be to provide specifically that when a after an incompetency proceeding is ordered, if the defendant requests the psychiatrist also to examine him for insanity at the time of the crime, he thereby waives his Fifth Amendment rights and is entitled to get that finding. I think you have to specify it. Because otherwise you couldn't force... It's got to be stated that way, that the defendant has to ask for it, because if he doesn't ask for it, then the report would be a violation of Shepherd versus Bowe if in fact it did give the insanity ruling.
I wouldn't say that the violation of Shepherd versus Bowe, mm-hmm. because I don't think the court has gone that far.
Well,
if you want to go that far, why?
The court says you can't ask him about the day at or near the crime.
But that wasn't.
No, it didn't say you can't ask him. It says cannot be
Shepherd
required to answer.
But we're talking about the insanity part of the incompetency hearing. That's what I'm talking about now. Shepherd does apply to that.
You can't order
him
to answer those questions.
Without any request from the defendant, without any waiver, proceeds to asking these questions, and the defendant responds, not knowing that he has a right, that's going to get out. Routinely, it's going to be distributed to the state, and they're going to have all this self-incrimination, and that's exactly what Shepherd versus Bowe goes to.
Well, except that Shepherd versus Bowe didn't arise in that context.
No, but it still affects the insanity hearing. Whichever way it gets out, it has to apply to it. Well, I don't know whether I'm right. I'm just kind of thinking out loud.
Well, but in Shepherd versus Bowe, the state was asking for the guy to be examined.
And the court ordered the defendant to answer those questions.
And he, yeah, that's right. And ordered
the
defense
and
counsel
sure
not
the
to
court
interfere.
I'm not sure the court is ready to go that far where the issue is his ability to proceed. Of course, you got this other fact.
Well, I don't think so either. I agree there.
You got this other factor that if he doesn't want to get the answer to that magic question, he only was insane at the time, he might stick around the hospital a long time before he ever comes to trial.
Well, the defendant takes that calculated risk. When he asks for, he gets the judge to give him that incompetency hearing, he may
but
be sitting there for years as a result of it.
It doesn't always happen on a defendant's request.
I know it. It's more often than the state.
Yes, yes, correct.
Well, the way the draft is right now, if we leave in language which says the report shall not contain any findings or conclusions as to whether the defendant is a result of mental disease or defect as we found in the criminal act charge, we can take out the words, but is not necessarily limited to. We're prohibiting the report from containing the information we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And we go straight back to the straight description, examination, conclusion. Relating only as to the ability to proceed. The other thing is, too, I'm not real familiar with the practical aspects of it, but I would think tactically it would be kind of an error to rely upon the state hospital to make your final determination as to whether or not you can interpose a plea of insanity.
I mean, it's a strategic matter.
Yeah, I mean, you've got your
Absolutely.
Own doctor with privilege, and you've got the state doctor with...
Well, that's the defense counsel's boo-boo. He does that. Strategically, probably a blunder, because most of the time the state hospital or the state psychiatrist is going to say that he is sane.
Right. Now that brings us down to the question of money, as to whether or not the saving of the money for the county by having one examination for two purposes is going to work, number one, and whether it's proper, number two.
Well, I think one examination for two purposes works. It works now, I think, Dave. Without getting into some of these constitutional questions.
It works, except it violates Shepherd's rule.
Yeah.
We all agree on that. It does work.
Yeah.
There's no technical problem with the psychiatrist doing this as long as he can ask all the questions he needs to.
And most defense lawyers, this is what they're really looking for. They're not really too concerned about whether he's able to proceed or not. I mean, the crucial question they're looking at is whether they've got a good insanity defense.
Defense lawyers ought to be more concerned about competency, because that's where his client is liable to wind up rotting his way his time in the hospital.
Yeah.
Sure, they're concerned, and if the report comes back and says, well, he's not able to proceed, you know, it's going to give him something to go on.
As a practical matter, the numbers who aren't able to proceed are relatively small.
Yeah, like a guy is really crazy at that point.
I just saw an ADA study, Judge, about that in Michigan. And of the people who were in this particular institution in Michigan, out of 750, 740 of them were there on incompetency, failure to be competent. So that would be evidently contrary to what you're saying.
Well, I think Trelevin, what Dr. Trelevin said at one of our subcommittee meetings was in agreement with that.
Yeah, the most of the people are there on incompetency and not on insanity, and that's because of the swinging
door
policy.
Well, but it's not that they're very long. No. I don't think they're swinging out.
Yeah, that's true, but in terms of the number who are not able to proceed vis-a-vis the number of guys indicted, it is
small.
very, very small.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
I think that generally when the defense attorneys use this route is really where they don't, I mean, it where they don't know themselves, and all they want to do really is to be assured that they're not overlooking a possible defense, really. And if they get a guy in there that they feel that there's any real possibility of the insanity defense, they come in and file a motion requesting the court to allow them money for a psychiatrist.
Yeah, and in some counties it's allowed, I understand, but not in all counties.
And at least that's what it's done there, and they get their psychiatric examination, but when they have them committed is where they really don't know, and they would just like to make sure that, I mean, they don't really think that he's insane necessarily, but they want to make sure that they're not overlooking something that, in other words, they want to reassure themselves that they're right.
How about another approach? Why not make the dual purpose examination initially by the court, either providing funds for a psychiatrist, or if the person has it done privately, then he pays for it himself. Then with the report back, strictly on the question of the ability to proceed, and then send them down to the state hospital for the official confirmation.
So it costs extra money.
Well, it may cost extra money, but at the same time, we're talking about some guy rotting in prison for it.
The way this is written, though, the court now, under 12, the way George has it, can either have a psychiatrist from the county do this or send him to the hospital. He doesn't have to send him to the state hospital.
Stay in the locality and have a psychiatrist there.
Yeah. It just gives the court the authority to have him examined. I mean,
but the psychiatrist is chosen by the superintendent of the state hospital, isn't it? Oh, Cheryl, please. Excuse me. I'm wrong. Okay. Well, maybe that takes care of a problem.
Point at least one qualified psychiatrist, or shall request at least, like, you know, some counties don't have a psychiatrist around. The only way they're going to have him is to send him up to the state hospital.
I understand there's only about 5 east of the mountains.
And gee, in Lane County, it was the exception to send a guy to the state hospital for this kind of thing.
Yeah, we very seldom have one sent to the state hospital for this examination. The only time that I can think of that we've ever had somebody sent to the state hospital for this examination was where the defense counsel and I both knew that there was something wrong with the guy, but we didn't know whether he was insane or not. And so we both agreed that he
send him down to get a double-barreled report.
Why don't we provide then?
So he sent him up there to the state hospital.
What's wrong with providing that the second half of the report goes only to the defendant?
Well, that's interesting. That thought has occurred to me, but unfortunately, Shepherd has an impact there, because the court said specifically it recognizes the fact that some states seal this kind of information, so that the parties, except the defendant or the court, whatever, wherever it's proper to go, no one else can see it. But our court recognized, based on experience elsewhere, that that kind of information has a way of leaking out, and specifically directed itself in reaching its decision to saying we aren't going to have any of it. We're not going to say we'll stop short by saying it'll be sealed and not available. We're just simply going to say it's too much of a chance and we won't do it. It's prohibitive. So the court, I think, has kind of forestalled that approach.
Does a doctor-patient privilege apply to a court-appointed, or where the court designates a psychiatrist?
That's a good question.
There is no doctor-patient privilege in criminal cases.
Stand just a bit. dispensary.
It's only in civil cases.
Right. Yeah. Only in civil cases.
So you can haul the psychiatrist in with a subpoena and question him at an examination.
I think that's, yeah, this is
if
one
the
of the
defense,
ways.
If you know that the defendant has had him examined by such and such a psychiatrist, you could probably haul that psychiatrist into the grand jury and find out what his opinion is going to be.
Well, then we ought to change that one.
I don't know. No, you mean where the defendant's hired him privately? I don't think so. I don't think so.
I've never.
I think that's doctor-patient. I'm not positive.
Well,
right.
But there is no doctor-patient privilege in criminal cases.
Yeah, but this is his own case, his own private evidence.
Yeah, this would be. I mean, if he's been hired by the attorney and this type of thing, you got a little different situation.
I take it that you believe in full discovery then.
As long as it applies both ways,
well,
then
we'll get into that issue.
I've got no objection to full discovery. I don't mind the defendant knowing all about my case, but I know all about his.
Well, probably better not.
We don't have that issue in this one, do we?
We will, when they hit the procedure. No, not here.
The only other time we've had the state hospital examination is where the defendant, they got her out of jail and then committed her to the... Well, had her up here at Holiday Park, is that the mental hospital in Portland, and then had her committed to the state hospital from Multnomah County here, and had her down there in the state hospital, and so then we got to the psychiatrist there, and that was our psychiatrist.
Actually, this kind of points up a fact that we tend to forget once in a while here. We're talking about procedure more than we are substance. And the biggest hang-ups in this whole thing has been procedure. And this bids what this forebodes the kind of problems the commission is going to have when it gets to the real procedural problems. Now, with respect to the insanity procedure, I pointed it out early that I felt that the commission ought to know that I was going afield from the pure substance rule of who's insane and who isn't under the ALI or McNaughton, because this is really the guts and the important part of the insanity defense, I think. So here, this is where we're really hurting.
Well, this is one area though of the substance goal where we need this procedure.
Oh yeah, it's intertwined
that
with substance, and it's just
insane. Is he able to proceed? And if he's insane, what do you do with him after? It's all tied in together. You
can't avoid it. But this certainly points up the fact of the real arguments and policy problems and trouble we're going to have when we get into the
well. Of course, here again,
to the procedural part of the code.
Shepherd versus Bull was not a case involving an examination of ability to assist, number one.
That's correct.
So, to the extent that we analogize, there's no point in getting ahead of the court unless there's a matter of policy we feel we should. And I don't detect that among anybody except George.
Except the non-voting member.
When are you going to write that article, George?
I'm working on it right now. If I find somebody to publish it, they're all in trouble.
But it seems to me that as far as specifically saying that we don't want them to say anything about sanity at the time of the act, that...
Well, it would be consistent with what you've already done with Section 7 to take both my added paragraphs out and say not another word.
You take out both of the underlying paragraphs.
Mm-hmm.
Could we solve our problem by saying the court shall provide for a qualified psychiatrist nominated by the defendant and approved by the court and actually make him the defense psychiatrist? With the option then of going to the state hospital?
Well, the competency thing is really, the theory of the competency thing is that he's not a defense psychiatrist, theoretically. He's a court psychiatrist.
Yeah, but if you want the court psychiatrist to save money or to be...
Well, I get
to also come up with a double-barreled approach and really hit the important thing, which is the insanity. And leave him wide open to the state, then I think we're doing wrong.
I hate to give away my article, but in my article, I'm going to really go completely overboard remove the court-appointed psychiatrist from the proceedings and put the burden of incompetency right straight on the court without any right or without any procedure which a judge could get a psychiatrist, I suppose, to help. But I see no need to have a psychiatrist at all in competency hearing. In fact, I see real drawbacks to it as far as the defendant goes. That's a little outside of the scope, but
you
I
mean
think
from an evidentiary standpoint, not having a psychiatrist?
No, from the standpoint of justice, the administration of justice. That is, this is really a legal question again. If you can say that anything is a legal determination based on concepts of due process and the practicalities of trying somebody, then competency certainly is a legal question. Psychiatrists will admit, none of them even ask about what a guy has to do. They have no idea what he has to do in defending himself or assisting at his trial. They're asking him medical questions, psychiatric questions, theoretical scientific questions that have no relationship at all to what he needs when he gets into the courtroom. My feeling is that the judge is the guy who does have that knowledge. His common sense, based on his observation of the defendant, his conversation with counsel, his calling in of any witness he wants to talk to, neighbors, friends, wives, and husbands, and so forth, that he ought to make the decision. This would eliminate the psychiatrist entirely and save a lot of money, too.
Our chairman is bleeding from every pore, picturing himself.
Well, the biggest criticism would be, well, how can a judge tell about the psychiatric or mental life of a defendant? I don't think that's really the important question. Can that guy help his counsel? Because really, the whole thrust of the criminal trial is to get the guy to trial. And too often, a psychiatrist isn't interested in that at all. So what if a guy is a little bit incompetent as far as the certain diagnoses go with respect to mental health? That doesn't mean he's not competent to sit there and help counsel. Why should he sit for 10 years?
Yeah, that's right. Took that too.
That's right. Yeah. I'm not alone in this. There's no reason in the world why he should be sitting there for 10 years when a judge, using his own common sense and his own observations, could say, well, this guy, he can help as well as any defendant can help.
I wonder, would you be able to find cases that in which the issue was the propriety of a court's ruling or it made its ruling in the absence of expert testimony?
Yeah, there's a case in Oregon that arose on habeas corpus in the federal court that said the court doesn't have to pay any attention to psychiatrists. Somebody, Gladden versus somebody, I've got a citation to it. It's not as direct a holding as I would prefer, but it definitely suggests that he's just a psychiatrist, just another witness. He's just a witness for the court.
I like that route myself. I would certainly like to see it go that way.
Well, you know, the question of competency, just sitting thinking about it, the competency to assist in a 2-week securities fraud case is a lot different than to assist yourself in a 1-day assault battery.
Who's going to know that best? Psychiatrist or the court?
George, you're scaring me. I think you're right.
Well,
gee. So the guy's a little nutty. The guy's a little crazy. Every day I see crazy people around the university. They got beers and they're walking barefoot, but that doesn't mean they aren't competent to help themselves.
It amazes me that if a person is really insane, he's probably incompetent to assist him, assist his attorneys in his defense. But there are people who aren't insane, that really can't communicate, can't tell their attorney anything. Are they incompetent?
Sure. Wouldn't a judge say, if defense counsel comes up and says, look, Your Honor, this guy just sits here and won't say anything to me. He drools a little bit. Or he groans, he growls, and he isn't helping me. He's all depressed. Well, the court's going to say he is incompetent. Why does a psychiatrist have to tell us that? Really?
Well, I'll write that article in here.
It always amazes me that they can come in with an insanity defense and yet can stand up and down and tell their client is just as competent as
medically, I think there's a distinct difference. Complete
difference. Well, I think.
Of course, I've never defended anybody, so I don't know
Let's remember
what the situation is.
Has that
far.
Notion.
Let's remember.
Doesn't believe it, Frank.
The guy is as guilty as he can be. Let's take a case where the guy is as guilty as he can be. He knows he's guilty. The defense counsel knows he's guilty. And the most he can get is a year or two. Why does he want to go down there on an incompetency hearing and rot in prison for 10? Or not in prison, but in confinement for 3 or 4 or 5 years? That's possible. If he can assist in his defense, if for no other reason than to walk in there and say, guilty, I'll take my 2 years. And the judge is satisfied that that person is waiving his rights to trial and all that sort of thing, let him. Why have him down there for 4 years because a psychiatrist convinces the judge that he beat his mother when he was 6 years old? Or some other relatively unconnected scientific reason.
Well, the judges do that right now, all the time. Jim, don't you? When somebody enters a guilty plea, you ask them if he's advised his rights.
You're taking paragraph 5
of the information, you go through the grand jury,
sure.
and you're making a determination of competency
one,
there.
Yeah, some people say the judge ought not guilty, to have the competency hearing because that takes him out of the umpire's role. Well, you just pointed out that he's not an umpire in things like pleas of guilty at all. He's participating.
How do you feel about that, Jim?
You mean, the thing that shocks me is that, you know, the best reason why you do things is we've always done it this way, you know. So when you determine a guy's ability to assist, you appoint a head shrinker. And it kind of shocks me when I think, well, you mean you do that without appointing a head shrinker? What do you do about these guys that don't drool in front of me?
You let them go ahead and go to trial if they want to. Why not?
What would you do during the proceedings if you had the idea that the guy was sitting there drilling a little bit and not saying anything? Would you stop the trial?
Yeah,
at
you
that
can
point
do it at any time under present statute.
Right, but do you appoint a psychiatrist in that situation, or would you, and then have the examination?
Yeah. Well, the thing is, how's a judge going to tell the difference between an uncooperative defendant and one who's incompetent to assist? How about the defendant who just isn't cooperative with his client, with his attorney at all, and just refuses to say,
but wants to go to trial.
He just won't say word one, won't even talk to you, you know.
Well,
what do you do then?
Let him go to trial. If the judge is reasonably sure that it's just surliness, why not? Try him. He stands mute. Not guilty. Okay, let the state prove he's guilty.
Yeah, well, maybe standing mute because he's incompetent.
Well, you're posing problems that would be tough for a court to decide. Undoubtedly, there's going to be that, by degree, that question. I would think that when it comes down to that, and I don't know. Now, I haven't tried any cases, obviously. I've never been a judge, and I've never had the responsibility for doing this. But it seems to me that, in 99% of the cases, a judge can tell by talking to the guy and looking at him and talking to his wife if he needs to, or the counsel, whether he's competent to help himself. And where he's in doubt in that case you pose, there's nothing in the world preventing him from going out and getting all the head shrinkers he wants to help him make the decision. What my suggestion is that we do not formalize and require that the judge appoint him and try to make the shift the decision entirely onto the court.
Well, why don't we just delete shall and insert may?
You know, of course, this draft doesn't reflect any of this thinking at all. This preceded my latest.
I would like to see us make that policy decision to move toward that.
I think it would take a complete redrafting of the language to reflect the preference for the court to make the determination without the benefit of psychiatry.
George, why don't you come up with a Section 12 and an alternate Section 12?
All right. Okay.
Reflecting the court to determine the question of competency to proceed.
Yeah.
Now, is it Section 13 or something that goes on and says about the?
Why, look at the money you could say.
Hearing.
Budget man.
I like that too.
Yeah.
About the hearing after the psychiatrist has filed his report and stuff.
Property tax relief.
Yeah.
Wonder how he feels when he sees the sheriff's budget.
Different
now, right?
Of course, You save money now, but if the court ever does foist off on you the necessity for having a defendant get his own psychiatrist in any event, well, you're not going to lose, you know, you're going to lose what you gain now, but that's somewhere in the future. Not
under your theory, even, George, if the court had the initial responsibility for making a determination, there was nothing that would prohibit the court from having assistance if there was a real bad question.
That's right.
And but you know, even there,
the court, obviously aware of the limited resources of the circuit, isn't going to automatically go get a psychiatrist. He's going to do what a lot of, as is done in a lot of cases, he's going to get lay witnesses. Have this man's wife come in here and talk to me. Have the jailers that have been watching him for 6 months come in and talk to me. Have his acquaintances come in and talk to me. He can make that decision in some cases quite validly. We're not deciding whether he's insane or not. We're just simply deciding whether he can help himself at trial.
I know that what actually happens is if the defendant raises the question, and then all it is the lawyer says, well, Your Honor, I have real doubt about his ability to assist, and I request a psychiatrist to appoint it. That's it. You appoint a psychiatrist.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this arises simply from a feeling on the part of the judge that, if you don't, you're probably violating his rights some way, or it's unconstitutional or something, mm-hmm. without really thinking about it. It's just, you know, we've gotten in the habit of doing it. Okay, we'll do it. Or if the state comes in. Either
well,
way.
Of course, and it makes a record, too.
And let's not forget that it's a good place for the judge to hide. I got to listen to this psychiatrist. He told me this is so I got to believe it. Or,
but at least he says, okay, we'll have a...
But don't you think that that's an important consideration too? It makes a record only for the court, but more mm-hmm. importantly for the lawyer.
And
particularly
also
when you've got so many court-appointed cases, this lawyer is concerned about making a record.
And this ties right back into Shepherd versus Bowe. Who knows best what self-incrimination is when he's asking a question on an incompetency proceeding? The psychiatrist or the judge? You're not going to start asking questions even in an incompetency proceeding. Well, you know good and well that the answers are going to incriminate this guy. You may not know about the link-up part, but you certainly are going to be much more sensitive to his self-incrimination rights than anybody else is.
Can the lawyer be present while this is going on?
Oh, yeah, I would think so.
Of course,
I would expect the DA to be present, too.
I checked, Your Honor.
Of course, the...
That's irrelevant and immaterial, Your Honor.
But this also enters into it that if the defense attorney doesn't raise the question, you know, if there's some substance there to it, question of ability to assist. He's worried also that the guy gets convicted and he gets down here and post convictions on incompetency of counsel, mm-hmm. which is becoming mm-hmm. more and more
very
popular. Favorite gambit to get a trip, you know, the port or somewhere. Yeah. So on. So there's a lot of bases that a defense lawyer touches just because he wants to touch him so they can't later say, well, he's incompetent counsel, and he gets his name dirtied up, and the state's put to the expense of a post-conviction.
You've got the public defender looking over your shoulder all day.
George,
I've
got a question now.
And the public defender isn't a bit bashful about pointing out your dereliction.
What we're talking about here is incompetency at the time of trial. And I know we've had situations come up where there's something wrong with the defendant, let's say. I mean, everybody knows. I mean, some of these drug cases, you get a kid in there that's all fouled up. And in other cases, the defense wants to get him up in front of the circuit court right away so they can get a psychiatrist appointed if they don't have money for to hire their own. So they want to waive grand, waive preliminary. They may not want to waive preliminary hearing, but they certainly want to waive grand jury and get him in if the grand jury isn't going to be meeting right away. Well, I kind of take the position that they can't hardly. If there's any question at all about their competency and stuff, they can't, shouldn't waive grand jury either. And there's no provision where the magistrate has anything to do with the competency, as far as like in the district court or this type of thing. It's all when it gets up there to trial, and so that consequently the it gets further and further removed from the time of the act and everything else before the guy can be examined. Do you think there's any reason or that some competency determination should be made, or is there any reason for it to be made earlier, like when the before the preliminary hearing in this area?
Well, I'd be afraid of something where you've got the decision being made by a DP. With all due respect to the Justice Peace Association.
Yeah. Well,
George, why don't you draft an alternate for Section 12? One line we talked about today, and we'll, next meeting we'll take them up. We're going to have to hold our feet to the fire in this section sooner or later, and then back up the commission. And it seemed to me that you draft an order and we'll take a look at it. Why don't we do that? Is that okay with everybody? Okay, that brings us to in court time, doesn't it?
Well, you don't want to take any more vote on any of these provisions under Section 11? Particularly under sub 3, did you want to take any formal action on any of that?
Well, I move we strike that.
Wasn't George just going to clean those up to meet the other standard we set down?
Yeah
I think
no, that was 2. Was that 11?
Well,
I lost numbers.
Yeah,
there.
Section 11 starts
on
page 9.
Long one?
Page 9.
Yeah.
Oh, you mean 12?
No.
I just said
12. Oh, excuse me, that is Section 12. I'm sorry. It's Section 12 on page 9.
I'm all lost here.
12, sub 3.
Well.
The new language is in there, wouldn't it?
Well, I guess we ought to get a...
Oh, yeah.
While Frank's out of the room.
This is the one that I'm going to draft the alternative to, but you still haven't disposed of the... formally of the two paragraphs that are underlined.
Well, didn't you say you were just going to remove them?
Well, did you vote to do that? I guess that
there,
was a
there hasn't been any vote on.
Yeah, I think that's what Don is raising.
What's your feeling about it? Do you favor removing the two underlined sections?
Well, it seems consistent with what we did before, doesn't it?
Well, I think the only question is really on the findings and conclusions, because the second paragraph of new language would come out to be consistent with what we did in Section 10. I really am more enamored with George's approach and what the new draft will contain. Don, you indicated you were too.
Yeah, very much so.
And I wonder if we're just spinning our wheels if we...
Well, let's wait until we get to the new draft.
Well, some of this material, at least down to the new... Well, I'm not even sure of that. I was going to say that in sub 3A, B, and C, excluding the two new paragraphs, would be probably that you'd want that in the alternative section too, and also sub paragraph 1. Well,
yeah.
It's kind of hard for me.
Why don't you draft a new, an alternative section 12? And then we can sit down and compare it.
Now, do you want, Mr. Chairman, do you want the subcommittee then to decide which of the alternatives they want to send to the commission, or do you want to send both to the commission?
Well, I'd want to see it in writing before I'd recommend sending it.
Yeah, I think
we
ought
to go over to an alternative.
It would be wise, too, because it's entirely new here. And
we
as far as I know, novel in the country.
Or send only one of them and put the other in. Well, I'd be in favor of taking a look at it. And what about, you want to go to inchoate crimes today?
I've got to go. I've got...
We're hurting on our time here.
While we're talking about that, I wonder about meeting times. Would it be possible? Maybe do it in the evening? I hate Saturdays, but maybe on Saturdays? Because
well,
between now and the end of the session, it's just going to be virtually impossible to get loose.
I was going
to
suggest that we, seems to me we need to meet as frequently as we possibly can. And it seems to me also that while the session is on, we ought to really meet pretty much for Dave's convenience.
Well,
because he's the guy with the...
Saturdays are better for me, too.
Yeah, you're going to have
to carry
the
burden on Saturdays,
when it
comes but
that's...
to the enactment.
Well, yeah, but I don't
that's
know
the only thing that encourages me.
No,
I've got to keep running until I have a vote on this thing.
It seems to me that, by and large, the rest of us can meet, but Dave has got a real problem, and frankly, I'd prefer to schedule a subcommittee meetings pretty much to meet his situation.
Yeah, I think...
Saturday's pretty much out for you.
Well, actually, Saturday's a better day, except that's the day I try to make a living at home on Sunday. But
there is that problem.
I don't know. It kind of depends on the